Disclaimer, this content is meant for information only and not as a diagnosis or medical treatment for any condition. If you or a loved one needs help, please seek out a qualified medical professional for assistance. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Katie Oshta, BSN, RN, IBCLC, and Infant Feeding Specialist. Quench your thirst for knowledge and travel with me across the nation to discover, learn, collaborate, and better serve clients from all over the globe. Let's ride and thrive together.
Jennifer Tao, BFA, MA, IBCLC, LMT, CSOM, has practiced holistic lactation and guided parents in raising their children holistically for over 25 years. Fascination with the psychology of wellness has led her on a 30-year journey exploring influences on infant health that come to define long-term human well-being. Her interests are focused in the areas of epigenetics and the microbiome, gut-brain health, airway function, oral functional competency, exploring the profoundly far-reaching implications of this work for breastfeeding dyads. While residing between the U.S. and France, Jennifer established an international client base and now sees most of her clients online, specializing in collaborating with her clients in resolving complex breastfeeding issues. With a master's in holistic health coaching, her reputation for guiding parents through these issues stems from her ability to integrate holistic modalities and an expanded skill set such as myofunctional therapy, cranial fascial therapy into her practice. Jennifer is a writer and lecturer offering workshops internationally and via webinar on her breastfeeding and epigenetic knowledge, gut health and healing, tongue tie and airway development, and holistic breastfeeding practices. After a decade in development, she now offers a year-long advanced course in integrative and holistic lactation. She is a founding member of the IATP, the International Affiliation of Tongue Tie Professionals, and is the breastfeeding section leader of the AAPMD, the American Academy of Psychological Medicine and Dentistry, and founder of the Holistic Lactation Institute. Jennifer is the mother of three children born at home in 1988, 1992, and 1998, and a granddaughter born at home in 2009. Please welcome Jennifer Tao to the podcast today. Thank you so much for being here today, Jennifer. I am so excited to talk to you. And I mean, we could talk for hours and hours, but to talk about everything from oral function, holistic lactation, and telehealth. You're just one of the most knowledgeable IBCLCs I've really ever met. And I just think that you have so much knowledge to share. And I'm really excited. So thank you for joining me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So I know you've been doing telehealth for a very long time, since 2008, right?
That was the very first time someone asked me to help. It was a mom from Costa Rica who actually reached out to me. There were very limited resources in her community. She had worked with La Leche League, but she had more complex issues than a La Leche leader could help her with. And so I used Skype because that's what was available then. And we did a Skype consult and we were able to resolve her breastfeeding issues. And I really enjoyed it. It was the first time I thought about doing that. As prior to that, as a La Leche League leader, I had done a lot of phone counseling. So I was very familiar with counseling people I didn't meet, but it was very different to do it as an IBCLC. In 2010, I moved to France. And so my company is in the United States. I did not work in France. So I worked from my American company. So I put my entire practice online. So that was in early 2011. So for 2 years, my practice was entirely online. And I just found that there was so much I could do in a remote practice that I couldn't do in person. It was actually the opposite of what you might have thought, where you might have imagined that there were deficits in working remotely. I just found that so much opened up for me to work remotely.
What kind of bonuses or what did you find that was better for you?
Well, I'm very confident that my skills increased dramatically because of working remotely. So when you're working in person with a dyad, you can pretty quickly get a little bit too hyper-focused on what you see. So that's one thing that can happen. And also you can be a little too hands-on. And I found that with working remotely, where I could not do any hands-on work, I had to expand my other resources. So I had to listen much more carefully to the parents. I had to observe the baby much more carefully. And I also found because I learned to use video that I could see things that I couldn't see that you just miss when you're in person with someone. So I could go back and watch a video, you know, a half a dozen times and catch just that moment where, for example, a latch goes wrong because the mom has the baby like well positioned, nice posture stability, and just goes for pushing the nipple in the baby's mouth versus letting the baby come to the breast. So what I learned to do is to use those videos, take screenshots of the videos, mark them up, often like split seconds apart, and send them back to the parents to look at, and they could make their corrections in a really efficient way. So I found that I actually, in many ways, improved the outcomes by working remotely. And in fact, even with my clients who I see in person now, so my practice is now about 80% global remote and about 20% in person. Even my clients who I see in person, babies don't always cooperate when you're in a room with them. They don't always need to nurse. They're not always hungry. They could be sleepy. They could be just fussy. So I can have the parents send me a video and I can still get a better input, better outcome than if I worked, than if I was only seeing the baby in person.
Definitely. But
the other piece of it is about 20 years ago, I started to recognize a lot of gut issues with the dyads that I was working with. And I kind of became known for doing that. In 2011, I wrote an article called Gut Microbes in Poop or something like that. And so I really started working in a very specialized way with dyads where gut issues were a problem. And that is something that most IBCLCs are not doing and were not doing and still are not doing. And so I found that I could help those families remotely who weren't getting any help in their local communities because it's a pretty specialized area. I did start teaching a course called Heal the Mother, Heal the Baby in 2010. Mm-hmm. And then I put together Gut Brain for IBCLCs a few years ago. So I am teaching more of that material to other IBCLCs, but there was a real benefit in my being able to take the areas of specialty, which are oral function and tongue tie and the gut health, and work with people all over the world.
Yeah, that's one thing that I think when I say that to people too, that if you just want someone to help you with positioning a latch, I'm sure there's somebody in your area. But for a lot of people that I see, there isn't someone in their area who's skilled at oral function or who knows anything about gut health, because that class of yours was so mind-blowing. I do have to say, I tell people all the time to take that class. And I sent someone a link just the other day and I said, prepare to really study your butt off, because it's more in depth than you expect. And I think it's more in depth than you expect because your knowledge is so much deeper and we're so used to getting easier classes that are not as detailed as that, not as in depth. And it was a very, very good course. It is a great course to take.
I think one of the things that happened in our field is that initially, because we came out of La Leche League, right? This field kind of evolved out of La Leche League, which I really appreciate that, because that foundation of mother-to-mother support and the foundation of trusting the mother to know her own child, right? That was the foundation of La Leche League, which is where I came from. So that was really important and valuable to me. But I think that what happened is that as the field evolved, very basic skills still are the foundation. And not that we don't need basic skills, of course, but anything beyond basic skills, there's really no formalized way to access those. So like for me, I stepped outside of lactation to get that material. I took tons of nutrition courses. I went back to school and got a graduate degree. I've taken a lot of courses in body work. I am a licensed massage therapist. I've studied craniosacrofacial therapy, orthobionomy. I'm a myofunctional therapist. So all of that material that as it applies to breastfeeding, I've brought into my practice and then tried to expand it to educate other people. And the two biggest ways I've done that are through the IBCLC masterclass, which I developed in 2017, and through the holistic lactation year-long certification course, which I started in 2015. So for me, I feel like it's really important that as a profession, we have a much deeper, broader skill set. And I am seeing more and more IBCLCs kind of taking that on and embracing that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we need to develop this profession for a lot more than, you know, latch and position. And not well, that that's wrong, but like you said, we all need the basic skills, but that should not be the entirety of a lactation consultant.
Well, one of the things that I like to say is that IBCLCs are not a referral vector. It's not our job to simply identify and refer. It's our job to facilitate. It's our job to coordinate. It's our job to manage the process from start to function. So we take a dyad where there is dysfunction, where there is compensation, and our goal is to bring that dyad to function and competency. And we should have the resources and the skills and the knowledge to do that. Coming back to working with telehealth, I will say that that is one of the challenges of telehealth, is that when I'm working with a family in a community that is not where I live, I need to find those resources. And so there are certain communities where I have tons of resources because I have so many clients in those communities, but there are other communities where that's a challenge. Mm-hmm. So you have to step outside the box, but you have to know what ought to happen in order to facilitate that. So I understand what body workers ought to be able to do. So it's easy for me to communicate with them, to evaluate what they're doing, and to help the parents find better care. The same with a release provider. I know what a release should look like and what providers should be doing, which is never doing a release without an IBCLC referral, for example. And so I know how to sort of find those people and facilitate that. An example is a couple years ago, I worked with several families, I think 6 or 7 families in China, primarily in Shanghai. And there was difficulty finding body workers. And so there are very few chiropractors in China, for example, and they're affiliated with hospitals, which makes it more difficult to access them. And so I found a Rolfer from Spain, who was amazing and brilliant with these babies. And then I found a American physical therapist who did cranial sacral therapy in Hong Kong. The release provider in China was doing incomplete releases. So one of the mothers there connected with a dentist in Hong Kong, who I then connected with and communicated with. I had her communicate with Dr. Kotlow about lip ties because that was something she didn't really know about. And we did a lot of sharing of videos and photos back and forth. And she did beautiful releases. Because the families had to go to Hong Kong, I connected them with the PT in Hong Kong. So they would go to Hong Kong, they would see the PT, get body work done, get the release, go back to the PT, get body work done, and then go back to Shanghai and see the Rolfer. So we had a really nice team that everyone could work with. So it takes some time sometimes to get that to happen. But that's an example of where we were able to facilitate good care remotely, primarily because I have a lot of experience here collaborating with a really brilliant chiropractor, with Dr. Ballone. And so I've learned how to do that. It's one of the things I encourage every IBCLC to do: go and sit in the office of the body workers in your community and learn from each other, because that's how you raise the bar for what parents can expect in a community, right?
Yeah, so, definitely. I mean, that class, the recent Making Peace with the Process, where we had IBCLCs and chiropractors in the same room, I've referred to body work for a long time, and I've spent time with different chiropractors and body workers, but doing it in that setting where we're both in the room with the babies and the mamas at the same time and watching how that interaction happens and how it can really change it was a wonderful class and a great way of, again, right, raising that bar, right? Not just, okay, I'll refer to body work, but understanding, what should I see? What kind of results should we see? And, you know, what should I expect from the body worker? And if it's somebody that I don't know that well, or that maybe doesn't, you know, see a ton of babies, how can I communicate with them and help facilitate this?
Exactly. And that's been one of the challenges for me, because I often see older babies. So I think I probably see more older babies than the average IBCLC, because frequently they're those parents who are still hanging in there and still struggling, but just aren't giving up. And so they're wonderful to work with. They're like my favorite clients.
I love them. Yeah.
They're so heart-centered and committed. And yet they have been through the mill. They are like beaten up, and they've often been, their intuition has been stomped all over, and yet they're still there. They have so much courage and so much inner strength. And so a lot of times they come in and they've done all this stuff. They've seen IBCLCs, they've seen body workers, And then they tell me that, you know, yeah, you know, I go 3 times a week for 3 months. Big red flag right there. Mm-hmm. You should have probably had 6 appointments over like 6 weeks. And so that's, so you have to learn how to assess that. You have to learn to see the baby, you know, watch a baby before body work, watch the baby after body work, and see if they've gained range of motion. Are they able to extend? Are they able to gain good postural stability at the breast? Are they able to get a deep latch? So much of that is reflexes. And I know you've talked to Brenna about that, and you're going to talk to Avery about that. So much of that is reflexes, but so much it is also the ability posturally to do it, right? And so it's not about just trying over and over and over again. It's about observing a baby and assessing what a baby can do. Because one of the things that's the most impressive about breastfeeding dyads is their ability to compensate. And you want to see those compensations. You want to look at that and say, this is what I see you doing to make this possible for your baby. And this is in many ways diagnostic for me, because it helps me to see where that baby can't do something. Because if a baby can feed well, they will. When a baby's not feeding well, it's because they can't. So our job is to assess why they can't and remove those barriers. And often those barriers are structural. They could be a tongue tie. They can be that the baby, you know, was crunched in your belly for 3 months, barely moving up in the right corner, not able to, you know, shift. And now they've got a torticollis, or they shared space with a twin, or the mom is 5 feet tall, whatever it is. And so you have to be able to assess that. And so often with those older babies, especially the ones who are crawling and walking, everything they're doing is compensatory. You know, they're tripod crawling. They don't have good postural stability. Everything is compensatory. And you can literally see the entire story. If you look at that baby at say 10 or 11 months, you can know exactly where they came from. So that skill, that ability to look at those babies and watch them move, watch them walk, watch them nurse, watch them take a bottle if that's what they're doing, watch them eat solid foods. And you can really understand what's going on and what needs to happen to bring that child to functional competency. And that, in my mind, that's our job. It's functional competency. It's not, you can barely limp by for a few months. That's not serving the family.
Right. Absolutely. But I feel like there's definitely a lot of over focus right now on oral function. Not that we don't focus on oral function, because you and I both see a lot of tongue tie babies. And of course, oral function is important for long-term airway health and for breastfeeding now. But there is this hyper focus right now on oral function. And it's like the sun, it's covering up everything else and it's blotting out everything else. And we're not seeing, or the family isn't being seen, as you know, the dyad's not being seen, the maternal infant wellness isn't being seen. Everything is so focused on just what can that tongue do? And can we do this oral function?
So this is one of the problems in our profession. And it's one of the problems in healthcare in general. It's not even within our profession. It's within healthcare in general, because we have a disease care model, not a healthcare model. And so basic human function like birth and breastfeeding are treated in a pathological way, but they're not pathologies, right?
Right.
And so we treat pathology in a very dissected kind of way. So we look at something, we say, this is the pathology and this is the treatment for that pathology. But breastfeeding is not a pathology. And yet we still treat it the same way. We hone in on one small thing and say, we'll fix that thing. And unfortunately, it misleads parents as well, because they become misled into thinking that a tongue tie release is going to solve their problems. But it isn't, for two reasons. One is that a tongue tie release is a procedure. You can't solve a problem like feeding difficulty with a procedure. You need a process. That process has to involve a functional assessment by an IBCLC who can then communicate to the body worker and communicate to the dentist or ENT what is happening functionally or dysfunctionally. And then you bring the baby as close to function as you can before that release, using oral exercises, using rhythmic movements, using body work, collaborating with the body worker, whatever your tools are. And then immediately after the release, you bring that baby as fully into function and that dyad as fully into function as you can. And that doesn't happen in the mouth. It happens body to body, human to human, heart to heart. That's what a dyad is. So it doesn't only happen in the mouth. But we're so we have such an allopathic model that we've now focused on the mouse. So now we think the release is the story. Okay, well, the release isn't the whole story. So now we're going to do functional exercises. And in some ways, you know, I always have to sit back and ask myself, what is my complicity in this, right? So in 2017, I felt like IBCLCs really needed the skills to do oral habilitation of babies. I had met Brenna Hayden when years ago, and she had, had me come out to Washington to participate in a conference. And when I heard them talk about reflexes, I was blown away. Number one, Brenna is an amazing speaker. Brenna is brilliant. And yes. And so I thought, oh my God, I'm missing all of this myself, right? And so that just kind of percolated in the back of my mind. And when I decided that I needed to take what I had learned as a myofunctional therapist, working with all ages, but I really work a lot with those babies who are like 18 months to 4 years, because that is not part of myofunctional therapy training. But because of I'm an IBCLC, I really could do that effectively. So I thought, okay, well, how do I bring what I know from myofunctional therapy to IBCLCs? But I can't leave out this huge reflex piece. So that's why Brenna was like the foundation of that course for me, was I had to have Brenna involved. And then I had to have Dr. Vallone involved, because the whole bodywork piece is so critical. And then I invited Sandra Colson, because even though I'm a myofunctional therapist, I wanted to present from the IBCLC perspective. So I asked Sandra to come and talk about myofunctional therapy. So when we put that course together, the idea was that we would offer the skills to IBCLCs that allowed us to work comprehensively and to habilitate from start to finish. We Right. ought to be able to do that. That should be our job. Rarely should we ever need more cooks in the kitchen than a body worker and a release provider and ourselves. We Right. ought to be able to manage that. Unfortunately, the oral exercises in many ways became the fulcrum for a lot of people. Well, which exercises should I use? Which exercises? And exercises are not about a sort of a set of instructions, right? They're meant to be diagnostic. When you give exercises to parents, you want the feedback from the parents. How did the baby respond to those exercises? What happened with those exercises? Because that really helps you to know where to go with that baby. So it's not like you're making a mistake. You can't really pick the wrong ones. But I think a lot of people got stuck on that. And that's why I did two things. One is back to the latch, which I did as a course with Avery Young, where I said, we have to come back to the latch, because even though there's too much of a focus on, oh, all IBCLCs do is, you know, position your baby, which is ridiculous. We do have to come back to our skills in helping babies latch effectively, because it doesn't matter if we release a tongue if the baby can't latch effectively. It doesn't matter if we do body work if the baby can't latch effectively. I often say that what happens on the table doesn't translate to the breast. It has to translate, right?
Right.
So I did that as a piece to kind of come back full circle and say, wait a minute, don't forget that latching is the whole point here. And also, that's why we did the Making Peace with the Process course, where we brought the IBCLCs and the chiropractors together in the same room to say, hey, we've got the same goal and we have to understand each other's language and vocabulary and communicate effectively so that we don't spend 6 months. And a mother doesn't come back and come in and say, yeah, you know, I've been going to the chiropractor 3 times a week for 3 months. So that within 6 or 8 sessions, we've got function, which is really what we should be doing. So I've tried to get away from that hyper focus on the oral space, because that's not where feeding happens, right? Because feeding is a whole body process. Yeah. And so, right. So that's where we have to go. So there are other professions now kind of pushing into this and saying, oh, well, we're the experts on this oral function, which I don't know how that happened, because they're not. But there's this push to do this. And I'm like, it doesn't matter, because the issue is not about that. The issue is about the dyad. Is the feeding parent able to make breastfeeding parent able to make enough milk, for example? Are they able to, you know, are they using the right pump? Are they using the right flange size? Are they in need of galactagogues? Do we understand their history in order to give them the right galactagogues and make the right recommendations? Do they have gut health issues? What do we need to do to support gut health? There's so much more to supporting a dyad than giving a baby oral exercises. And that's, we've gotten really stuck on that. And they're important and we should know them. But to me, they should be just part of our basic toolbox, and not the only tool we drag out.
Right. And I'm seeing right now a lot of hyper focus on this, that that is the be all end all. And, you know, I see too many and hear too many stories of people who either went to an LC who focused hyper on this, or sometimes even just they're often seeing an SLP or OT and they did all this oral function and had a tongue tie release and it turned out great. And they're bottle feeding and they lose their supply or whatever. And it's like, we're missing the point. When you try to take a dyad of a mom and baby ecosystem and you take it apart and you look at just baby's mouth, you've lost the point. Like,
well, the issue is that you can't take a baby, fix the baby, and ignore what happens when you put the baby back into that ecosystem, right? It's so important. There are so many things. For example, one of the things I ask a parent is, how does your baby spend their day? If we yes. do body work and we get a baby in a great place structurally, mm-hmm. but the baby spends their day in a swing, in a car seat, in a, you know, whatever kind of seat, and they're in flexion and they're not able to get mobility, or if that baby is swaddled, or that baby's in a snoo, mm-hmm. or that baby's being forced to cry it out, all of those things are going to negatively impact that baby's ability to process the experience of the release and actually gain function, because those are all the antithesis of function. So sure, a baby might need, will have to be in a car seat to go in the car. So yes, there are times we need to do those things. A mom right. might need to put a baby in a swing for 10 minutes to take a shower. But if the parents are aware of how those impact function, they will utilize them differently, right? It's the same with a pacifier. Pacifiers are really detrimental to oral development, to oral function. We don't talk about that. We need to talk about that. There's just a much more global picture that needs to happen. We have to take that wide angle lens rather than, you know, coming in too close to the one issue, which is that baby's mouth. So it doesn't really matter, kind of going back to that telehealth thing, and it doesn't really matter where you are. One of the best things about telehealth for IBCLCs is that geography is never a reason not to have a competent IBCLC, because you can find someone remotely, right? And I've worked with people. At one point, I counted up all the number of countries I've worked with and the number of release providers, which is a lot, like scores of release providers around the world, and body workers, it's even a higher number than that. And there are amazing people all over the world. I mean, you can find them. So working remotely is really rewarding. And helping somebody in a community where there wasn't mm-hmm. someone who could help them is very rewarding.
Absolutely. Frankly,
even more yeah. rewarding for me is teaching other people in those communities, right? That's why I love my courses, is because it brings people from those communities in and gets them educated as well.
Right. But I mean, what you did in Hong Kong, you basically created a little community of support for not just for your clients, but for these future clients. And you got everybody talking and learning and on the same page. And that creates this little microclimate for future families to have support in that area.
We had a really exciting process where in the very first holistic lactation course that I did, one of the participants was a medical doctor from the United Arab Emirates. And she was so, and she came to the residency in Connecticut. And she was so impressed with the material and the course and how it changed her practice and changed her family's life that she solicited a whole group of doctors and nurses from the Middle East. And I did a 2-year course for them, the same course, but they wanted it over a 2-year period because their practices were so mm-hmm. busy. So I did the same course, the holistic lactation course, for over 2 years for a whole group of people in the Middle East, so that we had this, you know, this huge uptick in knowledge and skills in that part of the world where there really wasn't any. And, you know, it made a really huge difference, I think. And since then, I've had other people also from the Middle East come and take both the holistic lactation course, the masterclass. And so, you know, I don't need to be the person who works with everybody. I would rather see IBCLCs skilled in those communities where they can build, you know, a host of resources for the, and especially in communities where there are very unique needs and circumstances. It's much better when the people in that community can care for their own, you know, their Absolutely. Own. So that's another thing that's been really rewarding about teaching remotely, but having worked remotely, I feel like informs my teaching. It allows me to be more effective in what I can teach as well.
Yeah, it's made such a big difference for me to work with clients. I am not working globally yet. I've been working pretty much with clients in the US, but just to learn and to reach out and find providers and you know, body workers and relief providers in different areas of the country and to learn what areas are facing and what areas have more resources than others. And it isn't always what you would expect. You know, when I tell people that I encounter all these kind of medical deserts where they don't have great body workers or release providers or knowledgeable people around, they're like, oh, you mean like, you know, in maybe in Nebraska or Montana or something? And I was like, no, like the Bay Area, Long Island, like there are places that are very, very populated. And yet I have a really hard time finding excellent body workers or a really great release provider, you know? So well, it's not always what you think.
One of the reasons that finding good body workers has been so challenging is because, for one thing, body work, it's its own controversy, right? There are people who still think body work is woo. And so you have a lot of pediatricians who tell parents not to get body work. You have a lot of other practitioners telling parents not to get body work. And you have a lot of IBCLCs who don't understand body work and aren't able to communicate effectively to parents. So they don't understand the value and the importance of it. But then once body work did become more popular, mostly it became popular because parents started recommending it to other parents, right? So parents would get good results, go on social media and say, hey, you know, the body work made all the difference for my baby. So people started to become more open to it. Like for me in 1997, I was struck off the referral list for the largest local hospital because I refused to stop referring to chiropractors. Illegal, by the way, but they did it. So that's what a big deal it was, that pediatricians were saying, you can't let any parent see this person because they'll refer to a chiropractor. So for many, many years, there were probably like 3 lactation consultants in the whole world referring to chiropractors. I mean, it was pretty slim. Tongue tie kind of became the turning point for that because we can't fix these babies without body work. So it kind of became the turning point as IBCLC saw that collaborating brought much better results. But what happened is that a lot of chiropractors, osteopaths, craniosacral therapists, lots and lots of different kinds of body workers liked working with babies and kind of saw themselves as the baby body worker in their community, but they didn't go out and increase their skills. They didn't go out and learn how to work with these tied babies. They didn't go out and learn how to collaborate and communicate with the IBCLCs. And so a lot of times they're the person, but they actually don't have the skills they need. And I don't see them really making the effort to get those skills across the board. Certainly some are. So I think that's one of the problems. I'll put that partly on the lactation consultants who don't take it upon themselves to communicate and to let people know when things are not going well. For example, I had a chiropractor in, maybe it was Ohio, maybe it was Michigan, somewhere in the Midwest, who was working with one of my clients. And we were getting some improvement, but not what I needed. I knew that baby needed the occipital condyles released. I knew the baby needed more range of motion that the baby wasn't getting. Mom was doing everything she could to position this baby. So I finally took a video, marked it up, sent it to the chiropractor and said, I need this baby to be able to do this. And she did it. She fixed it. I've had other chiropractors where I've had them get on a remote call with Dr. Vallone, and Dr. Vallone has talked them through or walked them through how to do something they didn't know how to do. I did that in France many, many years ago. I had a mom who had three releases, 2 tongue tie, 1 lip tie release. And we still kept going back to pain and discomfort. After, like, we'd get a few days of improvement with the chiropractor, pain and discomfort, a few days of improvement, pain and discomfort. And so I asked Dr. Vallone, I sent her some videos and she told me what still needed to be done. She got on that those days, it was Skype with that chiropractor, talked her through it, pain and discomfort gone. So it's that kind of level of being willing to learn. We all need to be humble. We just all do. And so when people are willing to do that, then we have a change in what is available. And I think you and I probably are seeing a lot of the results of people saying, I'm the baby chiropractor, I'm the baby osteopath, craniosacral therapist, whatever, without really getting to that place of understanding breastfeeding mechanics and how what they're doing on the table has to translate to the breast. You can't assess a baby on the table. The baby has to be assessed on the breast. Body workers should be able to treat a baby while they're nursing, while they're feeding. They should be able to take feedback from the parent and understand how things changed or didn't change. They should be able to hear the IBCLC. Like today, I sent a message to a chiropractor. I saw a baby yesterday And the things that I saw that were still a problem, I just sent a message to the chiropractor and I said, baby's still tight. I saw her in person yesterday. The tongue isn't going to have full mobility with the tension she has in her neck, shoulders, and floor of her mouth. She can't actually open wide. So mom is doing everything to get a great latch, but baby can't extend. Chiropractor wrote back and said, I saw her. We worked on a lot on right anterior, posterior C and hyoid was right superior and lateral floor of the mouth seemed more restricted. Occipital on right, left lumbar. She was much better after that. So like that communication back and forth. And now I can see that baby. Mom will send me videos. I will see that baby and see if what that chiropractor did is going to translate into improved range of motion, improved latch. And also it will tell me when the mother does her oral exercises, because we know the baby's tighter on one side, she can tell me if that has changed, if that has improved. So that's the kind of communication we need to move things forward.
Right. That's one of the things I think too with the telehealth is that the parents are our hands. I don't need to do this with the babies. I don't need to put my hands on or put my hands in a baby's mouth or do any of this. The parents are the ones who are going to be there doing it time and again and again and again, right? So being able to teach them to do it is what's so big.
I think it's a deficit when we do it. In fact, it's not like if I see a baby, I don't assess a baby. I don't ever put my hands on a baby because I'm always learning too. And so I welcome that ability to continue my own learning process, right? Mm-hmm. But I feel like I am a much better IBCLC for working remotely. And I think that parents have better outcomes when they are able to experience the process, when they can tell me, this is what's happening. I've noticed that my baby is softer today after that release yesterday, which is what a mother told me this morning. Mm-hmm. I noticed this 14-month-old who she said, I've never seen him eat without gagging. That's why she reached out to me. He's eaten twice since his release and hasn't gagged. And then I could prepare her and say, okay, when we get to that contraction phase at 4 to 5 days, those are the things you're going to watch for. The gagging might come back. He might seem tight again. And this is how we're going to get through that. So all of that feedback from the parents is how we move them through the process. When a mother says the baby lateralizes only to this side and not to that side. The baby, when I do pterygoid chews, is tighter on this side than that side. Or when I do this exercise, I stopped an exercise yesterday because of how tight a baby was. And I said, okay, we're going to get that baby looser before we do that exercise. So that feedback from the mother told me that's the wrong exercise. We're going to do floor of mouth release now before we do this other exercise because we're not getting the results. That's the kind of process. And so The parents can assess that when things are good and better because they're experiencing it not just by latch, but by what they feel when they do rhythmic movements, what they feel when they do oral exercises, what they feel just in general when they hold their babies. And That's more valuable than what I feel.
I think it also, not for everybody, but for some IBCLCs, it turns into this like wanting to showcase your abilities and being able to say like, look, I can do this for your baby and wanting to feel valuable. And unfortunately, we're then taking the focus off the dyad, right? We need to instead inspire or empower those parents to feel like they can do something with their babies. I mean, just the other day I'm seeing a mom of twins who the babies were already released and not prepared and not doing well post-release. And it's been about 5 or 6 weeks now and we're working and increasing a lot of oral function, definitely getting a lot better body movement and symmetry. And she told me that the babies absolutely love the rhythmic movements. And she said, she started crying. She said, you know, it's the first time I feel like I've touched the babies that didn't feel like a struggle or pain because the feeding is so struggling. And she did all this aftercare and wound care. And she said, she's like, I made them cry or I put them at the breast or the bottle and then they struggle to eat. She's like, this was finally something happy that they liked and I could do. And she was just in tears. And she's like, I can't believe how good this feels, you know? And that's the thing to remember too, is like, yeah, I could do a movement on a baby. Of course I know how to do that. That's not the point. You know, I want to teach them how to do it so that these parents can feel that. And then they are so knowledgeable. And if we just tap into that and help them tap into it and to really turn that on again, because unfortunately so many parents are told that their intuition isn't right. Right? They're told that what they're seeing isn't correct or what they're feeling doesn't matter. and that they're wrong about their baby or about the feeding problems or anything. You know, too often I hear clients just come to me and say, well, I was told that nothing was wrong because baby was gaining, you know, and it's such a problem. But if we can get the parents to turn that on again, and if we can, you know, inspire and empower them to say, oh my gosh, I can see and feel how different baby feels today. Or I can feel that on one side, this feels really good. But when I try to move baby's left arm, it doesn't move as fluidly and soft and as the right arm. You know, if we can help those parents, that's where the difference happens. That's when we get good outcomes and competency.
I think that one of the problems is that in general, where lactation is addressed is in a very, it's not in a nuanced way. And so those nuanced things that parents notice about their babies, that they turn only to one side, they prefer one breast over the other, their bodies feel really stiff, they feel really tight, those things are often ignored. But when you are focused on function, those become your barometers. They become very important. And so what the parents tend to notice about their babies is much more valuable, becomes a part of the conversation, and really validates the parents in a way that is not happening when somebody else is doing all of that for the baby or for the parents. So I also find that a lot of the tools and the skills translate into parenting in other ways. Like those rhythmic movements can be used forever. The right. ability to just feel your baby, recognize when your baby is feeling tension or tight or their function isn't good or whatever it is, and to have tools and resources to correct that is something they can continue to use. But I think one of the things in our culture that is so critical is the invalidation that so many parents experience, especially mothers in our culture. And so I think that this is just something I've noticed in the last years, because I've been helping mothers and babies for 34 years now. One of the things that I've noticed is that we've had a huge uptick in anxiety among parents. And that anxiety comes from being devalued. That anxiety comes from being told you're wrong when you're concerned about something. So a mother's concerned because her baby isn't feeding well. Your baby's gaining weight, you're fine. But the mother knows that it's not fine. Or a mother is concerned because her baby isn't pooping as babies should be multiple times every single day. So the mother's concerned and she knows feels it. There's something off and she's told it's normal and it's fine because we normalize dysfunction in our culture. If it's common, it gets named normal. And right. So underneath the surface, when you know there's something off and everyone tells you you're wrong, I think anxiety is a natural consequence of that. And so that's another problem that we're creating in many ways in parents by devaluing them, by dismissing them. And so this process of doing things remotely where everything is in the hands of the parents really is more validating to the parents. Now, I'm not saying you can't translate that into working in person. Of course, you can and you should. And we should do the same whether we're in person or remotely. But I know for me, it's necessary when you work remotely. So it really shifts your paradigm a lot. And so it helps you to do it also when you're in person. And I just find that often that isn't part of the in-person process that a lot of parents experience.
Right.
So
there's too much on certain factors right now. There's too much focus on either just the oral function or just weight, you know, and when I said I was seeing people in lactation telehealth, using telehealth, I can't tell you how many people were like, well, how are you going to weigh the baby? And I'm like, that is not the be all end all of everything. There are many other ways we can weigh a baby, right? There are plenty of other options to get a weight when we occasionally need one, because I pretty much never recommend the parents buy a scale. And I've had too many times where I've had parents that have had scales and then they reach out to me and they have just the anxiety there is way over the top.
Moving parents away from those kinds of external measures towards a measurement that they feel with their own hands, they see with their own eyes, they experience with their own hearts is so much more valuable.
Right.
So it's not like I'm never concerned about weight. Of course, babies need to gain weight. And when someone tells me their baby has dropped, you know, percentiles or baby hasn't gained sufficient amount of weight, you know, over, you know, whatever period of time, a week or a couple of weeks, of course, I'm concerned about that. We're going to take steps to resolve that. But I find that when that is our only measure, we can't solve problems because the only way to solve that is more food, right? We give more food. But what way do we give that more food? Do we need to increase the mother's milk supply? Do we need to do something about the transfer? Do we need to use a feeding tube at the breast? What do we need to do? And so much of the focus is just take a bottle, add some formula. And so it becomes very rigid as opposed to nuanced. So the more we use those kinds of measurements, the less we're tuned in to our own experience. And this is an example of that. I had a client who, as much as you tell parents that a tongue tie release is not a magic wand and that you will not have, you know, all things better as soon as the baby's released, it's a process, not a procedure. Everyone kind of hopes for that magic wand, right? So I tell my clients, you're not going to remove your supports. If we're using a feeding tube, we're going to keep doing it. If we're supplementing, we're going to keep doing it. If you're pumping, we're going to keep doing it until we know the baby can do it for themselves. I had a client where I said all of those things, and I'm really grateful the chiropractor heard me say it, and the baby wasn't gaining well enough. And I was like, how is that possible? Well, this mom is pumping. We're doing all these things. It turned out that she did exactly what I told her not to do. She dropped all the supports because the first weekend, the baby just did so beautifully, which is typical the day or two after the release, before it all comes undone, it has to be rebuilt. And she didn't tell me that she had done that. And so we had to go back to all the supports again and bring the baby's weight, you know, back up, which we did. Baby's great now. We had to bring the baby's weight back up. So that's an example of where we do have to be responsive and attentive to that. And we also have to remember that sometimes what we tell parents, they get so excited that the release is going to solve the problem that they often do the opposite of what we think they're going to do. And we have to have those conversations. Anyway, so that's just an example of where, you know, we definitely need to be attentive and paying attention to those things. But it's not, in many ways, those measurements undermine breastfeeding. They undermine the relationship. They undermine the dyad. They're not really a contributing factor. I actually don't like it when people use apps to track things.
Right.
Because I feel like you're not paying attention to your baby. You're not reading your baby. You're just, you know, you're putting some numbers into an app, but that doesn't really tell us what's going on.
But that's so much of what is valued in our medical system is that's all the pediatrician asks them. They want they want hard numbers. They don't want to have to write down that the mom says that the baby has more active swallows or that they used to fall asleep at the breast in 2 minutes and now they're active for 12. They don't want to write that down. They want to be able to write down went from 8 pounds to 8 pounds, 8 ounces. Like they want black and white numbers. And so that's what the parents are focused on too. You know, even parents will say to me, well, but if I breastfeed, how do I know how much baby's getting? How do I know if they got 2 ounces or 2.5 ounces? And I'm like, why does it matter? If your baby is happy and content after they got up the breast, why are we so focused on these external validation numbers? You know, I think, like you said, we are systematically in this country undermining parents, and especially these mothers, and not supporting their knowledge, not supporting their innate connection with this baby and with themselves and understanding of what they feel and what they see. And we're only really honoring the hard fact numbers. And we're not honoring the rest.
That's part of the medicalization of birth and breastfeeding, right?
Yes.
We've medicalized both of them. They're not pathologies. They're not medical processes. They're part of just life. They're just part of life. And one of the things I try to help parents understand is that breastfeeding is simply parenting. It's nothing. It's just parenting. And it will have all the ups and downs of parenting. And parenting will have many ups and downs. And if you can kind of embrace it in that way as just part of parenting, as opposed to a feeding process, I think you can approach it very differently. But we don't have a tendency to support parenting. We don't have a tendency to support sort of the heart of mothers, the heart of parenting. And so we kind of distill it down to these numbers and these weights and these values. And so, of course, parents are going to respond to what we've asked of them. But what I think breastfeeding needs to do and lactation needs to do, I hate saying go back to, because I always feel like we need to move forward, not back. So let's say move forward to where we have enough understanding that process of weights and measures has actually been invalidating and not really the most valuable, and that we need to move forward to addressing the sort of the relationship that's there, the relationship between the mother, the baby, the other parent, the family, the community, all of that is really what's most significant. So that's why I think it's so critical that we think about the dyad and not the baby. Because a baby cannot feed itself. The baby has to have another human involved. So we always have to think about the dyad. When we did the Making Peace with the Process course back in October, one of the most powerful things for me came from a chiropractor who said that what I learned this weekend was about the concept of the dyad. I hadn't thought about it in that way. I felt like that was the biggest win of the entire weekend, is if somebody can remember that the dyad is what we're there for, not only the baby, not only the parent, but the dyad, then we are successful. And that's where our support has to happen, is within that context. And if we can support competent function, because remember, the human infants are highly competent. They're highly competent from birth. And when they can't do what they're meant to do, something is interfering with their competency. We have to get out of the way. Babies are never lazy. Babies never prefer a bottle over the breast. But that's not what's happening. What's happening is in some way, their competency has been interfered with. And that competency is a domino effect in terms of the development of the airway, in terms of the development of the microbiome, in terms of the development of their relationships. All of our physiology comes from that place of competency as an infant. So it's really important that they have functional competency in feeding.
Well, I think that the fact that we fix, quote unquote, fix breastfeeding problems in this country by handing a bottle and some formula over shows a real lack of understanding what breastfeeding does and its biological imperative of what it does and how it shapes that airway, how it shapes the body, how the reflexes and the movement and the body to body feeding. I mean, a bottle is not body to body. Like, I've seen plenty of parents, we all have, prop a baby in a bouncy or a swing with a bottle, and they're not getting any body contact. Like,
well, and that's another place that when breastfeeding is the norm, then bottle feeding, when it's done, mimics breastfeeding. And I don't mean by creating fake nipples that look like a breast, but I mean is the way the parent holds the baby, the way the parent feeds the bottle, so that we teach parents that where a bottle is needed or preferred for whatever reason, that we choose a bottle based on breastfeeding, not by visual, but by the way the baby takes it, right?
Right.
That we feed the baby in a side-lying position so that the baby has control over the feeding, that we don't feed 6, 7, 8 ounces, that we continue to feed 3 to 4 ounces at a time with the frequency that we would breastfeed. That's really important, because some parents, for whatever reason, are going to bottle feed, but we need to make sure breastfeeding is the reference for that. But instead, we make bottle feeding the reference for breastfeeding. So people try to, you know, get in their 30 ounces all in the middle of the day in bottles that are oversized. Babies are sent to daycare and they're overfed in daycare, and mothers suddenly think they can't make enough milk.
Right.
Babies are asked to sleep through the night when babies are biologically not capable of sleeping through the night. Babies are asked to self-soothe when babies are not biologically capable of self-soothing. In fact, no one is. So, you know, all of these kinds of things that we're putting onto babies that reference bottle feeding in a very detached way as the norm, rather than breastfeeding is the norm, and any bottle feeding should be attached in the same way that breastfeeding is attached. And so that way, that allows a family that's using bottles to have a different experience of that feeding than outdated, outmoded way of bottle feeding babies. It doesn't mean that bottle feeding is the same as breastfeeding. You're not going to get the same oral development. You're not going to have the same microbiome. You're not going to have the same experience. I'm not implying that you are. But what I'm saying is that however parents are feeding their babies, what is really critical is that we don't gatekeep information and we allow them to know what the consequences are of their choices so that they can make the choices that make the best sense for them. And I feel like one of the things we tend to do is we gatekeep information. We treat parents as if they're incapable of making good decisions, as if they're incapable of understanding information, as if they're incapable of processing information. And we actually act in this very paternalistic, protective way. Like, we won't tell them that tell a mother that what she eats determines the composition and quality of her breast milk, which it absolutely does. Why would we not tell a parent that? Let them decide what they want to do with that information. So that's another place where I think we've really undermined parents is right. by, you know, that kind of gatekeeping of information.
I think too many providers think that that says some sort of judgment about it. And I'm like, well, first of all, depends upon how you present it. This isn't a judgment, but this is a medical fact, and we should share this information. If they're coming to us saying, does it matter what I eat when I'm breastfeeding? We should say yes. Yes, of course it matters what you eat when you're breastfeeding, because you are feeding your child. Of course that matters. How healthy your body is matters.
Throughout all of human history, humans have chosen lactogenic foods to support breastfeeding. It's part of our physiology. All mammals do the same thing. They seek out certain foods that support their ability to make milk and feed their young well. So there's the, in my mind, the damage is in misleading and lying to people. It's in withholding information. It's not in sharing information. It's in right. withholding. And in doing that, we actually determine the outcome for other people. And I don't think we have the right to do that. Okay. So that's another place where I think breastfeeding has become so marginalized, in that we have made it seem so much about simply a food that comes out of a breast rather than a living, dynamic fluid that comes from a living, dynamic human, right? Yeah. That's what's happening there. And so all of those experiences are really important. And the way the mother is experiencing her own life and her own history, all of those things matter. And we should be having those conversations. We should be honest about that and talking about those things, and let parents make decisions based on all of that information, not based on redacted information, which is kind of what we do. But anyway, that's kind of, I know we went off course a bit there.
I know. I was even going to say one little thing with the bottles is I even tell parents too that these oversized 8-ounce bottles, it's a lot like having these oversized huge plates that tell people they should fill up their plates, or how large that has changed in, you know, the last 40, 50 years. Bottles don't need to be 8 ounces. Your baby does not need to take 8 ounces. That is not what they need. But the parents start thinking it is because that's what they see, right? Because that's what they're told. And when you understand that that's just really, I mean, it undermines their breast milk relationship, because their breastfeeding relationship, because then these parents start to question, well, maybe I'm not making enough. Maybe I should start supplementing the baby. And before you know it, yeah, now they're filling that huge 8-ounce bottle with a bunch of formula.
Well, part of that is that we've become a pumping culture as well, right? So mothers think they have to pump whether they ever need to or not. When can I start pumping? Well, what's the reason to pump? Are you saving milk to go back to work? Do you just need an occasional bottle? Do you need to build your milk supply? Like, what's happening? But there's this perspective that pumping goes with breastfeeding as if it ever did. It doesn't. There's no need for most people to pump unless, again, are you going back to work?
Right.
Is there a need to pump? But what I'm saying is that there's not a physiological need for most people to pump.
Right.
And so there's this thought that you have to create a stash, save milk. But there's not the education that comes with that that says when you do that, you are changing the composition of the milk. Babies drive the composition of the milk by the way they nurse, by when they nurse, by how they nurse. And when you add a pump, you are now changing the composition of milk. It's not going to be the same as what the baby asked for. When you create an oversupply, you are changing the composition of the milk. Those are problematic. And we don't talk about that. We behave as if an oversupply is some kind of a gift. It's not. You're setting yourself up for mastitis, for plugged ducts. It's not a gift to have an oversupply, spoken by somebody who did not intentionally have an oversupply. So we act as if more is better, bigger is better. None of those things are true. Enough best. What we need is best. There's not a better when we make more. So there's so many ideas around breastfeeding now that presume the need to do things there is no need for. They presume a need for bottles. They presume a need for pumping. It presumes a need for pacifiers. It presumes a need for, you know, overfeeding or whatever it is, as opposed to this is all the available information. What's best for you? Mm-hmm. There's the assumption that this is what you need to do. This is what everyone needs to do. And that's generally not correct. And it creates a lot of stress and trauma for a lot of people.
unfortunately, we're very much a capitalistic society and we have a product to fix everything. And people also assume if there's a product for it, then that means that they should have it. I mean, I can't tell you how many clients come to a prenatal visit with already a whole bunch of bottles and a pump and a, you know, a lot of times a snoo or breast massager. They're like, well, I must need to massage my breast to breastfeed, right? Like they sell these things. So I must need a breast massager. I'm like, you don't need a breast massager. Really? Trust me.
And well, it really just is my background's in advertising actually. So it's just really a testament to how well marketed, how well we're marketed to that we don't recognize we're marketed to. So that we presume that these things are necessary without recognizing that, wait a minute, humans have breastfed for millennia without any of those things. So why would we think they're necessary? They were never necessary then. How are they necessary now? They're not. And yet we don't stop, take that pause and say, wait a minute, do I really need that? Is that really necessary? There's such a fear around not enough, not enough, not enough. And I will say this, we've also misled mothers for many years by saying most mothers make enough milk. And that's not, well, maybe most is true, but the number we used to say, oh, less than 1% of mothers can't make enough milk. There was never, ever any evidence that those numbers were true. Mm-hmm. And because we have such an uptick in insulin resistance and metabolic disorders, many more mothers do not make enough milk than did in the past, than were not able to in the past. And that's a huge, real problem. So, but there are other solutions to that, right? We solve that problem by normalizing metabolic function. We don't solve that problem by giving formula. Right. So, right.
Or
so,
even galactagogues. Like, that's not the answer either. The answer is to get mom into a state of wellness.
Right. Exactly. I mean, and galactagogues are often a part of that. But
a lot of times they are. A lot of times they're a stepping stone, right? A bridge that we may use to get somewhere, but that isn't the end result. The end goal isn't to have mom on a galactagogue and to say, woohoo, we fixed this because now she's making enough milk. The end result is maternal and infant wellness.
Yeah. So the issue is that we have more problems than we've had in the past. Right. We have, in general, a less healthy population. Parents themselves are less healthy. Babies are being born with more complicated issues and more health issues. Primarily more gut issues. The microbiome is really kind of a collective disaster in the West. And mm-hmm. So we're just seeing many, many more problems related to epigenetic presentations of, high palates, small jaws, receded jaws, tongues that don't move well, guts that aren't working well. So it's a much more complicated problem than we've ever had in the past. And so in my mind, as lactation consultants, we need to up our game. We need to have more skills. We don't need more cooks in the kitchen. We don't need other practitioners to do our jobs. We simply need to do our jobs more efficiently. We need to collaborate with the people who can help, which might be body workers, which might be release providers, which might be naturopaths or functional medicine doctors, if we're talking about, addressing metabolic issues or thyroid issues. But those are the people we need to really be collaborating with and working with to solve these issues. It's not about more oral stuff. It's really about, we want function within the diet. That's really what we're looking for. And it's about the parent, the feeding parent is a part of that. It's not simply what the baby's doing, right? So that's really where I think we need to go and be as a profession.
And I think that that's hopefully where we are going. Some days I think that we're going to get there, and other days I think we're not even headed in the right direction. So it depends, but I have hope still that that's where the profession is going to go and that we're going to advance and raise that bar and start supporting these families for true wellness and not just, weight gain or oral function or something, because that's what we're here for. We're here to support and to see these dyads, and we're in such a unique position. I feel like so many other providers don't really see the dyad. And like you said, there's some chiropractors that do or body workers that will see both, but so few. I mean, no pediatricians, no OBs. We're so segmented in our medical system, because it's also not a wellness system, that they're not seeing the whole person. And we're in such a unique position as IBCLCs to really see that dyad and to really help and support them through this most unique transition of life, that it's really important that people step up and really get into this you know, and really.
Well, one thing I want to say is that just as with any profession, you're going to have people who are highly skilled. You're going to have people who, you know, probably either very new, you know, they're building their skills, they're developing their skills, but they're highly motivated to do that, right? And when it's a complicated case, they reach out, they look for resources, they look for help. I mentor many other IBCLCs on, you know, labs and gut issue. And
you've answered many of my questions.
Sure. And so those are either of those groups of people are people you want to work with. And then they're going to be people who they take the least amount of education to maintain their certification. They don't reach out. They don't learn new things. They don't up their game. But that's the truth of any profession. That's going to be true of doctors. It's going to be true of auto mechanics and hairdressers and
teachers
chiropractors.
And lawyers. Yep.
Right. And so I think what happens within our field, people will say, well, I saw a lactation consultant, they didn't help me, or I saw a chiropractor and they didn't help me, or I had a bad experience with a chiropractor, so I'm never going to another one. That makes no sense. If your mechanic isn't doing a good job, you find a new mechanic. If your pediatrician is really in conflict with your parenting, you find a new pediatrician. Parents also, in my mind, should be looking for IBCLCs who are among the two groups, the highly skilled IBCLCs and the IBCLCs who are always focused on gaining skills. And the highly skilled IBCLCs should always also be focused on gaining skills and mentoring the other people who want to learn. But that's who you should be looking for. And so if you have an IBCLC who isn't that, find someone else. Don't assume that someone can't help you, because every problem has a solution. At least that's what I tell my kids. I'm pretty sure I'm right about that. Every problem has a solution. And so you need to find somebody willing to work with you to find the solution.
Right. And we need to keep staying curious and humble. I say that a lot. I say that we should always be curious. We should be asking why. We should be, you know, asking the parents to wonder why. We should be exploring why things happen and learning more and more. And that's when I started doing this. It helped me to podcasting, especially to help me to reach out and talk to other providers. And it's really helped me to grow my network of those that I really want to call on and ask and learn from. And, you know, not only have I asked you many questions, but I have also taken just about almost all of your courses. You know, I mean, I think that being curious is a very important thing. And I think if you've stopped asking why and you're not curious anymore and you don't want to learn, it's time to do something else in life, regardless of what career you're in. I think that when you get to that point, you're probably not doing your best anymore. And maybe life's trying to tell you it's time to change it up,
right?
You know? And I'm just so thankful for your time today, Jennifer. I know that you're very busy. And I'm just very thankful that we could talk and get this information out there and talk about how, you know, holistic lactation is different and how telehealth can be such a huge benefit to so many families that no family anywhere should go without expert IBCLC support. And that's what telehealth brings, really, is it can bring an expert right into their home, no matter where that is. So thank you so much for joining me.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
When you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change you. I hope that you enjoyed the podcast today and learned something new. If you know someone who would benefit from this podcast, please share.